It's festival time and it's Thursday night and we've been reading about the weather. Now, where I left off last night, you can see we had some effect. We scared the weather out of here today. Boy, this sounds dramatic. I'm not sure that my temperament would even let me sound convincing as I read this. I mean, it's really poetic, and I'm not poetic by nature. That's not my style to sit around and smile all the time and write poetry. Though there are other kinds of poets. But I'm going to read it anyway. I'm going to try. I'm going to read this. I'm just trying to work up to it. Poetry doesn't come natural to me. Singing didn't either. Here's a gift membership in the Smithsonian from a King's House. You King's Houses do so many nice things for me. And then look at this. Nobody. You won't see this on the alternative Antipode channel. You know we have an Antipode? How many of you know we have an Antipode? That Antipode. You won't see this on the Antipode channel. It says, "Dear Doc, I know you're a collector of Paul. Now, this is a far cry from a stamp. Nonetheless, I thought you might get a kick out of it. Now, this beer tastes good, and I don't even like Beck. Sorry, it's not cold. Now, I've seen Kirsch beer. That's church beer. You ever seen that? Well, I've never seen this. St. Pauli Girl. St. Pauli Girl beer. Now, that to me is the height of insult, that you can get it on beer and you can't get a stamp in the United States. Now, you voice the face, stay away from this. I want you under control. You engineers, stay away from it, too. And I guess that's two. I got two in my collection to prove my restraint. I was flying somewhere in my our King's House pilot of Faith Center Air Force, which consists of one single-engine plane, Charlie Brown. We were flying high above the ground somewhere, and he gave me a Billy beer, can of Billy beer. At one time, there were collectors. Now you have to pay people to take them. St. Pauli Girl and Billy Beer. So I have two. I'll just put them on a shelf in Doc's pad to tempt my attorneys and frustrate them. But I got to do it. Great glowing galaxies, boy, that's the way it starts up. Great glowing galaxies of light hang as if motionless in a timeless continuum. In one of those galactic spiral vortices of light, whew, gives you chills just thinking about it. In one of those galactic spiral vortices of light, I could do this with stained glass tones. A small and almost insignificant dwarf star of spectral class GI, or G1 rather, spins quite rapidly in its seemingly slower orbit around the center of what is known as the Milky Way galaxy, itself comprised of some 100 billion other orbital star systems of varying sizes and colors. Now that small star is, itself, orbited by 9 small planetary bodies which are constantly bathed in a storm of solar particles emitted by that star. And that star is referred to by the inhabitants of its third planet as the Sun. Almost 4,700,000 tons of matter are radiated by the Sun each second in the form of charged, each second, in the form of charged particles and electromagnetic radiation. The inhabitants of the third planet call their abode Earth. At the present time, their scientists are in a great state of confusion over the strange and obviously unpredicted behavior of the sun. Their long-accepted mathematical models of the sun had forecast a relatively long life for it before it was to enter the red giant stage, supposedly some 1 billion Earth years hence. Recent abnormalities in the sun's spin rate, surface oscillation rates, and sunspot activities have worried them a great deal. Perhaps they will understand in time. Maybe. That's the end of the poetry. According to an article, here's where it was last night. According to an article written by Gary Hughes, February 78, which was reprinted in the Australian Sunday Times newspaper. This is the weather report. I've only done two in the last 7 years. Here we are, counting this one. Australian Sunday Times newspaper, his article stated, "The world is facing a mini ice age." His article entitled "Mini Ice Age on the Way" stated, "The freezing weather which brought southwest England to a crunching halt this week and buried the countryside under mountainous snowdrifts is here to stay. For experts say it is part of the same weather pattern that paralyzed Scotland and New York in January and caused freak heat waves in Australia and other southern hemisphere countries." Elsewhere in his article, Hughes quoted the well-known astrophysicist Dr. John Gribben from the Science Policy Research Unit at Sussex University. According to Dr. Gribben, the cause of the cooling in the northern hemisphere is... That's where I left off, wasn't it? Right there. Now, we saw last night that man has the capacity, building upon the concepts of Tesla, to treat this Earth as a conductor, and stationary waves around this Earth can be drawn upon for major energy reactions, and that weather can be affected by man. Now, you cannot set up poles and then antipodes from some pole that you're broadcasting from without affecting this Earth that has a fluid state about it. We pointed to the number of earthquakes that are happening. We haven't yet preached on Matthew 24 and the accompanying passages in the Gospels where Jesus spoke of the signs that are to come to pass at the end. I want to push that a bit further tonight as I show you that a combination whiplash is working. A whiplash of man messing around with the elements and the elements themselves, where the problem is compounded by the interworkings of both. And maybe the statement, when we went out here last night, my secretary said that she used to say, weather's not what I used to remember it. And people would say to her, oh, you just don't remember. I think I convinced her last night by her words that weather is changing. Things are not as they were. I want to get into that. Can I read this book, The Cosmic Conspiracy, a little further tonight? Now I'm going to get into the pyramid, because they are related. We've dangled you on the pyramid while we've pursued other things, and we're not finished with all the other things. But to pick an analogy, for example, when we talked of the 10 tribes, there are certain fixed points in the research where the evidence has a weight that only somebody obtuse with their head in the sand will say there's nothing there. I had to work hard to keep from being categorized, and pull me down, Gary, just a hair. I had to work hard to keep from being categorized as the British Israelite in a box that includes all that early British Israelism taught. I'm not. I'm a Bible student, and I'm a historic churchman and a Christian in the solid foundation of God's Word, and always have been. I major on the repeatables of God's Word, what is said over and over again in His book. But the Bible is a closed book in many sections. If you do not recognize that, though not always referring to them as separate, God does distinguish between the house of Israel and the house of Judah when He's talking of the distinction between the 10 tribes and the 2-tribed kingdoms of Israel and Judah. The 10 tribes went into bondage before the 2 tribes did, and God played them off against each other in His teaching. By analogy, you can't preach on the book of Hosea and certain sections of Isaiah and Jeremiah without recognizing, and also Ezekiel, that God, by analogy, treated them as 2 wives. One, a wife that was dispersed, driven away, but never divorced. Another wife that He gave a bill of divorcement to, and it was as though she had never been His wife during that period. Israel got the divorce. Judah got the disbursement. You cannot read Ezekiel without knowing that those two clusters of God's people must be brought together again before the end. You cannot read of the 144,000 in the book of Revelation. You cannot read of the distribution of the property and restored Israel during the millennium in the book of Ezekiel without knowing that God will find those tribes. And it is the height of ridiculous ignorance to look for the lost tribes as a handful hid out in some cave somewhere. They must be as the multitude, analogous to sand of the sea. They must be so powerful that no nation, it's got to be a nation so powerful nobody can conquer them. They've got to possess the gates of their enemies. You've got to find somebody that fits the distinguishing characteristics. Now, in looking for those things, there are certain clusters you can settle on. It wasn't until the 1800s that you could clearly find the scattered 10 tribes in archaeological language that gave us one of the reasons they disappeared. They were called by different names, either Saki or House of Qumri, Assyria, Qumri, Persia, the Medo-Persian Empire, Saki. They had to translate the monuments at Behistun. They had to translate the archaeological finds in remote Assyrian border posts to figure it out. You had to equate the historical sections of Esdras and Josephus, and they had to dig in the 1800s at Hallstatt and Latin to uncover the characteristics of the Celtic tribes, and Celtic archaeological research had to develop along with that which had come about in the Mesopotamian plain, in order to be able to find this fact that the Celts had traits that can be paralleled with the 10 tribes at the time of their disappearance, and that the Celts appear mysteriously in exactly the place that the 10 tribes disappear, and that they have tribal traits and viewpoints of eternity and viewpoints of immortality that are analogized to the very tribes with some take-on characteristics from their Assyrian conquerors that the Israelites carried into bondage had. Now, beyond those solid clusters of fact, you then take intelligent projections and come to some conclusions, and I've tried to fairly distinguish between interpretation and the facts. We were only able to make our own judgment when we just read and read and read and read and dug and dug and dug, and certain gestalt common denominators leaped out. Now, when I get into the pyramid and start really teaching it and not baiting you as I've been done, you're going to encounter the same thing. The problem with the British Israelites is somebody would take a piece of information, like the 4 blind men, they're trying to figure out what an elephant is. And one runs into the leg, and one runs in, grabs the tail, and one runs into the trunk. and they each come up with a different description. If they had limited themselves to describing what they saw and felt instead of trying to project what they thought it represented, they'd be accurate. Now, the first British Israelites got carried away and went too far. Bad scholarship took over, and scholarship is a disciplined science. Bad scholarship took over, and we begin to see the fault that characterizes so much of religious pronouncements. People take a little piece, tip of an iceberg, and then become overnight authorities, project their own theory, and spend the rest of their life defending it because they've gotten themselves committed. And they get careless. They do not distinguish between what has a heavy weight of evidence and what comes from some remote, shaky, shadowy, unidentifiable, or questionable source. It's like the critique that I laid down on Mel Terry's book that spread through the charismatic circles on the Indonesian revival. I said when it came out, it'll hurt it more than it'll help it. There was nothing to put down Mel Terry, whom I think was a sincere man. But when you give the same credence to a third-hand hearsay report of some 72-year-old lady that claims to have seen somebody walk across a river walking on water, and you give the same credence to that report and put it on the same weight of evidence as an event that can be testified to by a half a dozen to 100 witnesses that were present as eyewitnesses, you weaken your credibility on all fronts. Now, that's what British Israelites have done in some cases, not every case. That's why I wanted to separate myself from them. And the overreaction to the British Israelite overinterpretation produced error on both sides until the baby was thrown out with the bathwater and evangelical Christianity is just steered completely around vast sections of Scripture because of the polarization of those two extremes. Likewise, pyramidologists, to borrow their word. And as you have seen, and I've pointed out as a rule of interpretation, when you're close to truth, expect the devil to throw up decoys. He'll always do it. Pyramidologists, many times with inadequate bases, went too far. And as I go through all the books, you're going to find that, like the studies on the 10 tribes, no one book has yet been written that's adequate because they all sweep in premature interpretive stuff before they get the factual job done. Likewise, you will find it's difficult, and I did that, by the way, on traditions. Every book I would tell you about that explained traditions, I couldn't really recommend it because they wouldn't stick to explaining historic fact, the source of the traditions. They would always use the interest that had been garnered to go on some private preachment, which makes the book unable to be recommended by any objective scholar, because to recommend it is to suggest you're also recommending their interpretive and doctrinal portions instead of just the factual presentation. Pyramid is the worst of them all. I got books here galore. J. Bernard Nicklin, Testimony in Stone. I've got Davidson's, by the way, great volumes, which are probably the greatest on it. Here's The Great Pyramid, Man's Monument to Man. I have a very close friend I work with. He's a pain in the neck. Pain in the gazoo, too. He heard me teaching on the pyramid, so he's going to get ahead of me, so he bought this book. He'd read it. He even sat here on the festival one night and read it. He read a 176-page paperback and became the world's expert on the pyramid. He doesn't have to listen anymore. He's got it all. I mean, this guy, he writes well. The Great Pyramid, Man's Monument to Man, by Tom Valentine. You can buy that in most of the bookstores in Los Angeles. But immediately he read it to the end, came to his own conclusions. He doesn't listen to what I say, whatever I say now. he anticipates where he thinks I'm going because he thinks he knows. There is a group within the United States, Howard Rand. They produced Destiny magazine for years, and I've come in here and carried Destiny magazine in. I have all of their bound volumes. I've gone through them, got them dog-eared. Same problem. When they're right, they're right. When they're wrong, they couldn't be more wrong. And you better know how to tell the difference if you're going to dive into them. I consider one of the finest scholars on the subject of Glastonbury and on the subject of the pyramid in America today to be E. Raymond Capt. He's an eloquent writer. He has a knack of simplifying the complicated and stating it. I do not mind recommending his books, and I recommend it the way I recommended Woodrow. I feel the same way about Ralph Woodrow and his book on Mystery Babylon. It's probably the best simplified presentation of the traditions that's ever been put in print. In this case, there is an honest difference recognized by both sides. Woodrow, for example, is a historicist in prophecy. I would make a bet that if he's listening tonight, he would say that I am a futurist, and I would be put in the box. I am. But what has not yet been revealed is I'm both. I am a historicist and a futurist. And as people, before I had the time to get into the book of Revelation, would listen to me for 7 years and put me in the Southern Baptist traditional box of prophecy when I preach on the rapture, it wasn't until I got out the magnifying glass and started carving into the detail, we then were able to point out I don't have any difficulty and haven't for 20 years moving through many church circles because I understand there's more than one rapture. Now, Ralph Woodrow, I could recommend with the full knowledge that he is identified in his book, whether he now is or not, with a prophetic position that is not identical to mine. Likewise, E. Raymond Capp. But he's a scholar and a good man and has probably done the most thorough work, and I'm indebted to a lot of his work, on the mechanics of the pyramids, and have no hesitancy in recommending his books, and that's the one I brought out here, The Great Pyramid Decoded. Probably the most thorough job that's ever been done on the pyramids, and because it's so thorough, it thereby contains some weaknesses. Because it was dated, he knew it so well, he was convinced he knew it all. I hope I never ever get... I kid you sometimes and say when people disagree with me, they have a right to be wrong. Most people can tell when I'm kidding. You do not get a PhD in any field without, in the expansion of the circumference of your knowledge, being humbled by the fact that at the same time you've expanded the circumference of your non-knowledge, what you do not know. Now, there are some things I'm very sure of, but not absolute on anything. Adam Rutherford has written 5 volumes in pyramidology. His only problem, he was so sure the end of the world would come in 1979, he stuck his neck out. That's the problem that people have when they stick their neck out. Here's George Reifert, Great Pyramid, Proof of God. And then here's John and Morton Edgar, Great Pyramid Passages, which is an anthology of multiple writers or writings on about every aspect of interpreting the pyramid on the inside. I've already told you Destiny's book after book. One of the popular ones, The Great Pyramid Decoded. He relies almost totally for most of his dates on Rutherford in the 5-volume study of it. It's Peter Lemaitre's, The Great Pyramid Decoded. I'm trying to figure out how he and Cap got away with that. Somebody is going to be in trouble somewhere. And I like Cap, so I'm on his side. That's their problem. But this one is very respectful of Rutherford and the works that have gone before, but criticizes the work of Rutherford and previous ones for interpreting the pyramid solely, in his view, in the light of, or with emphasis on, the Judaic Christian tradition as though it was written with that group in mind? Well, the answer of Rutherford would be they did it that way because that's what God had in mind. This book tries to go way into the centuries beyond and somehow link Buddha and everybody else to the pyramid. Now, I'm telling you, if you wade into this, if you want to stay confused, just wade in. Unless you're prepared to spend enough hours a day to sort it all out. Now, I'm going to lead you through all of these. You'll find such things, for example, as here is George Reifert. He's got a diagram of the pyramid right in the opening, right on the cover. Now, his dates, as he lays them out, will have the critical date line of the pyramid that lines up with the pole star Draconis and the star Alcyon and the Pleiades and the Taurus constellation that line up where the north pole star shined directly down the descending passage to the pit, which was the symbol of Satan, and the vertical lines pointed directly to that star in the Taurus constellation of the Pleiades that dates the pyramid date line. You'll find that he picks 2144 as the critical date, B.C. And going in pyramid inches from that, he has the Exodus start at 1486 B.C., and he has 1914 end, where the A.D., by going on a straight inch line, where the great step begins. Excuse me, I hiccuped. Don't look over at somebody in the room and say, "He hiccuped?" Yeah, I did. We'll settle that. We haven't got time for discussion on that subject. So 1914 comes at the bottom of the step. The fundamental agreement point in your chart is there's only so many pyramid inches encompassed between, if an inch means a year and you start out at 2144 B.C. and go to 1914 A.D., counting an inch for a year, there's only so many years between 2144 and 1914, right or wrong? I mean, yeah, there's only so many years. So the pyramid is not inaccurate. It's at what point you start with what year. But once you settle on a year date, what's between one point and the other point can only be so many years because there are only so many inches between. Now, with his theory, he's got the critical date 2144 B.C. If that is the accurate date that those two stars lined up, the dragon star and the Pleiades lined up in a crosshair that is accurate, if this dating system was accurate in projecting back exactly when those two stars lined up, then he's exactly right in 2144 B.C. being the time, September of that year, Exodus of out of Egypt then would come in 1486 B.C., and the 1914 date, A.D., would come at the foot of the Great Step. Well, here comes Rutherford, who's done the most thorough job on the dates, and his dates are different. Instead of 2144 B.C. being the point of lineup, he has 2141 B.C. They're 3 years off, right? But he's starting from the same fixed point on the passage. So if he is 3 years different from the other guy starting here, then he's got to find another 3 years on the other end. If you start with this line at 2144, you got 3 inches more, right? So as you count the inches and go up the passage, you end up at 1914, the necessary inches, right where the big step is. You see that? But if you start here at the same scored line, 3 years earlier, or later rather, 2141 B.C., because we're working backwards, then you got to push 1914 3 inches further. You follow that? So on this chart, this guy has 1914 coming 3 inches further in at the end of the Grand Gallery, past the big step, just at the entrance into these lower passages. Now, the one thing that has not changed is the pyramid. There's still only so many inches between this line and the bottom of the step. But if you start this line with a date that's 3 years later than the other fella, 1914 is going to come 3 inches later. That makes sense? The whole key is which of these two guys are accurate on when these two stars lined up. Now, when you're talking 4,000 years, 3 years may not be that critical. But as you read all these books, you're going to get confused trying to figure out which one of them's right. One guy says this happens in the spring of 2141 B.C., and the other one says it happens in the fall. Now, that's significant because the equinox occurs twice a year, when the day is exactly equal, day and night's exactly equal as the sun in this rotating, wobbling, spinning universe that the earth is a part of. The sun crosses the equator at a certain time twice in a year, and the whole year that goes around produces your year. But as the days become equal, as the sun crosses the equator, it can be the same in the spring or the fall. Otherwise, southern and northern hemispheres would be mixed up. What spring here is fall down there. But when the equinox rolls around, the days and nights are exactly identical. Now, in trying to project back exactly when, 2,000 years B.C., did this line that is shooting off to the Pleiades cluster of stars, and this line that left the North Star that in that century happened to be, or at that time, Draconis, shine all the way down to the bottom of this line, perfectly aligned. Was it 2141 B.C. or 2144 B.C.? Now, that's what we'll help to sort out as astronomy keeps protecting it. The pyramid doesn't change. The inches do not shorten or lengthen in order to fit somebody's theory. But people's theories try to confuse what's going on. Another big debate that goes on about the pyramid is, when was it built? They think when they discovered that this was the benchmark line, they can count the inches back to the opening, and that opening, therefore, becomes the date in which it was built. Hogwash. Anybody smart enough to build it could have built it to make it look that way. You will never know when exactly it was built by the evidence that is presently available in the world today. Anybody smart enough to build it could have built it after these events to coincide with that symbolic event of the Draconis star shining down the pit and the Pleiades with its meaning that I haven't gotten to yet directly overhead. Smart enough to build it, they could have built it after the date or before the date. To think they had a groundbreaking ceremony at exactly 2625 B.C. is only conjecture, because the pyramid inch moved back from the benchmark has the opening at 2623 B.C. Now, one of the reasons these two people argue is because it was discovered that Gregorian's calendar, or the Gregorian calendar, was off. And some people have argued Jesus was born 4 B.C. This guy is totally convinced and probably has the solidest evidence he was born in the fall 2 B.C. Now, those benchmarks have got to be resolved. You say, you're going to tackle it? Yeah, I sure am. I'm just trying to tell you so we get it out of our system. What book are you reading from? If you expect to find a book that you can read that'll say everything I'm saying in one book, you ain't been listening very long. Now, we're going to go through them all, including this one that I have one friend thinks that's all you got to read. That's it. I'm going to go through them all. Now, the fundamental point of the pyramid is here we go from the outside of the pyramid. There's scored lines, a benchmark that pinpoints a certain date when a certain star that is the symbol of Satan is lined up with another star. And this was the star that is the North Star, that it was so aligned, you can walk down it now, and a North Star will shine at an angle, but as you walk down it, you'll get out of the beam of the star. But at a given point in history that astronomers have pretty much pinpointed now, this star, Draconis, shined all the way in a straight beam, perfectly aligned. And at the same time, directly over these scored lines, so many pyramid inches in, is another star that speaks of God's divine grace, and we haven't talked about it yet. This is the path of this present evil world. And there are inch to a year, a chronological graph that is worked out in a key room called the antechamber, that tells you each pyramid inch, which represents 1/500,000,000th of the diameter of the earth, represents a year. But when it turns sideways into the pit, you have what in the map represents a blow-up. You've seen maps of a state with a blow-up of a city. You have a blow-up as we get close to the end of the details of the path of this present world, and I can trace right down this the path of history, mankind without God. At a certain point, the ascending passage takes off. It's got a low passage first that represents the period bent down under law that breaks out into a great gallery. Just before you get into that gallery, there's a step. Now, the distance in pyramid inches between here to here, and here to here, and here to here is the same. Depending upon the date that you start, you have significant dates pointed out. You have the Exodus from Egypt. You have the birth of Christ precisely planned in what's called the Christ Triangle, linked to another side road into the Queen's Chamber. You have the crucifixion of Christ exactly so many years later, whatever it is. I'm going to leave it out at this moment because I'm going to diagram the triangle for you on the Christ angle and show you the pyramid shows the exact connections in dates in pyramid inches between the birth and the death and resurrection of Christ. There is another little pyramid up here, the Christ angle, that shows the work of Paul, believe it or not. And the inches, depending upon what this starting date is, bring you to 1914, either at the start of this step or at the top of this step, or at the encounter with the end of this gallery, and I'll show you which one we'll choose. The simple facts are the prophetic plan is laid out, and when you go sideways, it suddenly moves to an inch to a month, and an inch to a month as we move to the closing moments of time. And as you look at this heading south, entering into the north entrance, the axes of the pyramid, we suddenly find immediately they got off center, 286 inches. You can figure that out by feet. And the whole trip leaves them off center until they get to the King's Chamber. And for the first time, the King's Chamber is sort of designed like that to right angles. You can turn right, not just directional meaning, but also right in other areas. And you turn right, and in the middle of the King's Chamber is the open coffer, which realigns back to the center of 286 point something. The displacement of man's sin is corrected in the King's Chamber, and we're back to the coffin, or coffer rather, that is symbolic of Christ and the open tomb, and we're back on center again. Those principles are clearly into the pyramid, and I want to be able to teach us how to follow the route of this present world, follow the path that leads upward into this coffer of the open tomb and into the King's Chamber, show that the Jews turned aside and did not accept the grace that was in Christ and end up in their own place of dealing, and the pyramid becomes a wondrous confirmation of God's book. But I'm not going to exaggerate it. I could preach if I never saw the pyramid. But the wonder of God laying down 4,000 years ago a plan of the whole world that He controls until 1914 is precisely pinpointed. And the time of the age and the shaking at the end of this world, and it shows a 6,000-year timeline. Now, the accuracy of the pyramid's measurements are settled in a wonderful way. There were two agnostics on the subject that did the work for us. Now, one of the greatest books in proof of the resurrection of Christ was written by an attorney that set out to debunk it. Frank Morrison, who wrote Who Moved the Stone? He was an attorney that decided he had disproved the resurrection and demythologized the story and proved that Christ didn't need the resurrection, the good man Christ could stand apart from the myth. He ended up writing the book Who Moved the Stone, perhaps the most convincing proof of the resurrection in any modern book since those ancient classics, Sherlock's Trial of the Witnesses and others. In the pyramid, Davidson, who has done the most monumental work of all, even more than Rutherford, and Rutherford couldn't do his work without Davidson. Davidson went down to prove there was no prophetic or spiritual meaning in the pyramid, and ended up writing the most convincing proof after his own conversion to the truth. There are two Petries. You'll hear Sir Flinders Petrie, great men of science from the British Isles. Typical of filial rebellion, the son was embarrassed at his father's lifetime of devotion to the pyramid and his theories of the royal and the sacred and the primitive profane inch and the measurements of the pyramid. So he went down with the zeal of a rebellious son to prove there was no spiritual meaning in it, took measuring devices to completely debunk all that his father had done, didn't know that in the process of doing it, he proved it. Now, I'm telling you, the research on the layout of the pyramid is there. Thoth, it's credited with the Egyptian Book of the Dead. The Egyptian Book of the Dead is not a book about the dead, but they used to bury manuscripts with the mummies in order to give the soul direction into the future. And as they begin to dig again, with concentration in the 1800s and dug up the mummies, you remember when King Tut's tomb hit the country, they then began to discover these manuscripts buried with the dead. The Egyptian Book of the Dead dates back beyond history as we know it. Nobody knows its origin. Legend credits it to Thoth, and I'll tell you who about Thoth at another time. The Book of the Dead starts straight out the gate indicating the pyramid is to be given spiritual interpretation of progressive deliverance of man into enlightenment. They have analyzed and given words to each of the passageways. This is truth in darkness. This is truth in light. The Egyptian Book of the Dead is clearly looking at the pyramid as having one purpose, and that's to communicate the ultimate enlightenment and salvation of mankind through the coming of a Messiah.
This is the end of Side 1. For more of the teaching, please turn the tape over to Side 2. Thank you.